So this is a title slide for my talk right now, and it's also an advertisement for my talk on Friday, which is the last talk of the entire conference, so I thought it needed some advertising. What I'm going to try to do today, I think that many of you have seen the astrophysics ABJ letter with the maximum results, but of course in such a short paper we can't get across all the systematic tests we've done and all the design of the experiment and whatnot, so I'll try to go into some of those details now. It's all hi Al. This is the cast of characters of Maxima. Maxima is based in Berkeley, and although much of the experiment was designed and built there, there were critical contributions from several institutions, including detectors from Caltech JPL and attitude control from Italy. About half the list you see here are experimentalists, and the other half are theorists that work who work primarily on data analysis. This is what the instrument looks like. This is a scale on the left here. The light comes in from the sky, bounces off a 1.3-meter dish to the receiver. We point the telescope on the sky by rotating the entire inner frame versus their outer frame in elevation, and we rotate the entire gondola in azimuth via these reaction wheels up the top. This is a side cutaway of the experiment. So again, light's coming from the sky to the 1.3-meter dish here. We modulate the primary mirror around this axis here, and the reason we do that is to reduce scan synchronous noise. Obviously, what's happening is the illumination on the primary is constant, so that reduces the scan synchronous noise compared to rotating a secondary mirror. We've gone to a lot of effort to keep the side lobe response of this telescope very low, and that means having a LEO stop here and a field stop baffle there, and we've cooled the secondary optics so that all this baffling does not affect the sensitivity detectors by increasing the loading. Here you see the bolometers, and we cool them to 100 millikelvin with an adiabatic demagnetization refrigerator. Liquid cryogens are there. And here's what the focal plane looks like on the sky. We measure 16 pixels simultaneously on the sky, one color each. They're all 10 arc minute, full width half max. There's 8 at 150 gigahertz, 4 at 240 gigahertz, and 4 at 420 gigahertz. This is what the actual instrument looks like. The scale of this picture is about a foot and a half in height. Here's the focal plane down here. These are horns and light pipes. This entire plate here is held at liquid helium temperature. And then a very short gap away, this entire section is held at 100 millikelvin. So again, you see light pipes, filters. These are metal mesh filters by Peter Ade that define the bands, and finally bolometers at the top. This is the CMB photon eye view of the focal plane. And these horns on the left here are the 150 gigahertz horns. We're diffraction limited at 150 gigahertz, so we're using smooth wall conicals. And we can get away with the smooth walls because we have a LEO stop. Then at higher frequencies, we go to Winston horns. So you see those for the 240 and 410 gigahertz channels. Now, one of the complementarities between the Maxima experiment and the Boomerang experiment is that they fly for longer, and we've had to push quite hard on our sensitivity. So what we've done is we've gone to the trouble of cooling our bolometers to 100 millikelvin, and we have 8 of them at 150 gigahertz. That's our main science frequency. If you put them all together, you can characterize the sensitivity with this figure of merit, 40 microkelvin root second. So, of course, what you do with this number is take this number, divide by the number of seconds square root that you dwell on a pixel, and that gives you your noise. And what you can see here is that it takes us less than 1 second dwell per pixel to get to a signal noise one on the CMB. So this is unprecedented in sensitivity, and I believe this is still the world record for sensitivity of a CMB receiver. That's true. It's ineffective. Okay. You can get your tomatoes over there on the side of the room. Okay, so as we know, the optimal signal noise per pixel in terms of getting the power spectrum is about 1. And this is the classic trade-off between signal noise per pixel and sky coverage or sample variance. But what we do is we go a little deeper than that, about a pixel per second, to get to a signal noise of several. And that's so we can break the data apart to do systematic checks. And I'll show that checks such as those later. So about 10 to the minus 17. So raw sensitivity is only the start of doing a good CMB experiment. Of course, control of systematics is of paramount importance, and where that all starts is the way you scan the sky. So what we do is we rotate the primary mirror back and forth. That's a half a hertz. And then on top of that, we rotate the entire gondola much slower. So the dual modulation, that's all at constant elevation, and that's all the modulation in azimuth. So that's one line here on this diagram. So as the sky rotates, we sweep out a fan like this. Then after about 2 hours, we change our elevation in our azimuth scan center, and we remeasure the same part of the sky again with this cross-linked pattern. And as we've heard about already in this conference, we've heard a little bit already about how important cross-linking is to make good maps, and we found that in our analysis. So now, as I've just said, cross-linking removes map striping. And an important part of the maximum experiments is we measure on multiple timescales. There's 4 timescales here. One is 1 second of the mirror scan going back and forth, 60 seconds for the gondola scan going back and forth. The sky is rotating at a constant velocity. And then 1.5 hours later or so, we go back for a cross-link scan. And actually, there's 5 timescales here if you count the fact that we come back a year later to measure again. So what does this do for us? It allows us to measure and reject systematic errors. So errors on any one time scale, we can characterize those. And we also get 2 independent maps of the sky. And I'll be showing those. This is the picture of the Berkeley part of the experimental group in front of the instrument. Here we're in Palestine, Texas, right at launch. And you see Paul Richards, Shoal Hanani, Celeste Winant, and Bachman Robbie are students at Berkeley, and me. Everyone has their pretty launch photo, and this is ours. And this was the launch of Maximum 1, I think. So the first thing we did in Maximum 1 when we got up to float is we calibrate off the dipole. I think a lot of you already know the motivation for this. It's quite a large signal. It's 3 millikelvin. And it's really an ideal calibration source because it's very well measured by the COBE team and has the same frequency spectrum as the anisotropy that we're looking for. So what we do is we simply rotate the entire gondola around an azimuth, and we get signals out that look like this. So this is signal versus time. And this is just the raw signal. There's absolutely no filtering done on this. So you can see that just in the raw data stream, we can see the dipole. And so that level of signal to noise is really one of the reasons why we were able to calibrate so accurately. What you see below that is a model of this data. So it includes a model of the dipole, a model of the galaxy, and there is some atmospheric contamination in here. So we use the 410 gigahertz channel to regress that out. So if that's all included in what you see here. So when I subtract these, I get this, which is fairly consistent with Gaussian noise, except that the galaxies, because our pointing isn't perfect, but we ignore the galaxy crossings in our calibration. Because we're ascending and the bolometers are still cooling. And I should say that the atmospheric component, although we model it correctly, only is significant for the first about 20% of the data and then goes away thereafter. So although we can use all the data, the last 80% or so doesn't have significant atmospheric contamination. And the accuracy just of the dipole calibration itself is about 2 to 3% at 150 gigahertz. Then you have to add in the fact that there's a time-dependent calibration from flashes of the stimulator lamp. So total is 4% as we reported in our paper. The other important thing that we have to do is map our beams. And as we try to go to higher and higher Ls, this becomes more and more important. And this is another area of complementarity with Boomerang. I think that we had a brighter source, so we were able to do quite a nice beam map. We use Jupiter as a point source. And we do as scans with the primary mirror, and we just let Jupiter drift through our focal plane. And we get about 200 measurements just like this. So this is one sweep of the bolometers through Jupiter. Signal noise is several thousand. And you can see that we can get quite a nice measurement of the beams. in two dimensions. This is what they look like. And these contours are 90%, 50%, 10%, and 1%. Signal noise is good enough that we can get to 1%. In fact, we actually have measurements down somewhat lower than that. And that's very important for evaluating this beam integral for comparing Jupiter scan and the dipole scan. Actually, thanks for reminding me of that. So what you can see here that there's a little bit of asymmetry in the beams. And when we first started the analysis, we were concerned about that, obviously. And a postdoc at Berkeley, Prati Wu, spent quite a lot of time investigating how to treat asymmetric beams. And there's going to be a paper about that coming out in a couple weeks. But to answer your question, what he found is that if you have a mild asymmetry, such as you see here, that you can use a symmetric approximation. There's one symmetric beam shape that you can use as a good approximation. And so that's what we did. And he showed that the errors from that are very low. So basically, you have to take into account the complicated scan strategy that you have with the asymmetric beam. And it turns out that there is a symmetric beam that doesn't necessarily have the same full width half max as what you naively guessed there, that does a very good job approximating in the mild asymmetry case.
Is the beam run by
scan rate? No, not very much at all. So and that was by design. Our bolometers are quite fast, and that's why we chop at half a hertz rather than say 2 or 3 hertz. Okay, so the next thing we do after measuring our beam patterns is we do our actual CMB scan. I already talked about the cross-linking, and here's declination in the y-axis and right ascension, and here are the two scans. You can see there was a little bit of pilot error, and we didn't quite get one cross-linking on top of the other there. The area of this part of sky is about 122 square degrees, or a third of a percent. There's 4,500 beam-sized pixels in here, so that's about six times the COBE data set. So that's it's quite a large data set, and the average noise is about 40 microkelvin per pixel. Now, just as maxima is a fairly large jump in complexity in terms of the instrument, the data analysis is also quite a big jump compared to things at least that we've done previously. And at the beginning, it starts out quite similarly. We start out with raw data that we have to clean, calibrate, reconstruct the pointing, and measure the beam shape. But here's where it starts to get more complex, and this will be the subject of more talks later today. We have the time ordered data. We have to characterize the noise and make the map. And because our noise covariance matrix isn't perfectly diagonal, we have to take into account all the correlations. And since it's a pretty big data set, this is computationally quite a hard task. But the data analysis team has worked really hard to make this tractable. Now, going from the map then to the power spectrum is yet harder in terms of computation. We're using the MADCAP package by Julian Borel. And, of course, you spend most of your time going through this loop of making maps and power spectra and looping back to the time-ordered data, but eventually, and doing systematic checks along the way, but eventually you get off this treadmill and get to where you want, which is the cosmological parameters. So this is a map of the sky, and this is an intermediate stage in the data analysis. So this is the maximal one field. This is, again, about 11 degrees by 11 degrees. You can see the temperature scale here. Signal to noise is about 3 average, higher in the middle. And this particular map is Wiener filtered just for presentation purposes. Of course, in the actual data analysis, we don't use Wiener filtering. Okay, so now I'm going to move on to talk a little bit about systematic tests. And as I said, we tried to get enough signal to noise that we could break up the data set into subsets and still have enough signal noise to be useful. So here's an example of that. We reported 4 different channels in the Maxima 1 paper. And so one thing we can do is we can break it up into 2 channels versus 2 channels. And this actually has larger pixels than what we use for the final power spectrum. This is 8 or 10 arc minute pixels. And we used 5 arc minute pixels for the final data set. But what you can see is that the structure is very well reproduced. if we split the data set into these two halves. A similar thing here. This is the sum map of all four channels, and this is the difference map of two channels versus the other two channels, and there should be a parentheses around here. So this is A plus B minus C plus D, and you can see this gives quite a good null when we subtract them away. That's right, it's consistent with noise. Another thing that we can do is we can show CMB1 versus CMB2. So these are the two scans that we did. And the reason it looks, reason they have a funny shape is because we're only considering the overlap region of the two maps. So it's not, doesn't have exactly the same shape. But this is, these two maps were made essentially 2 hours apart and at a different telescope elevation angle from each other. And yet you can see that the structure is fairly well reproduced. And so this is a very good argument against side lobe response causing much of our signal because we're at different elevations for the two scans. And it's also a very good argument against atmosphere because the again, we're at different elevations and actually we've moved quite a bit in 2 hours. Yeah, and it actually turns out to be a pretty nice null.
What is the RMS?
These two? I don't think we did an RMS yet of that. This is pretty new, this map here.
But
that's right. It's actually surprisingly good for no cross-linking. Yeah.
So it's a volumetric, they have shifted maps.
So it's a poor man's cross-linking.
Okay. Each of those is four channels. Right, but it's this scan and this scan. The first four channel wall.
Yeah, you see multiple, but they're all passing the same direction.
Yeah.
Right? So in fact, they don't need cross-linking.
Well, it's pretty good without it.
No.
Over
design.
It's much clearer than your noise. Five. Right? Single noise per point is five on each one of the maps.
That order.
Right, there are lots of one that aren't together and have a few times in the left, so it's a great
issue. Follow spectrum is called 4-0, so I can follow spectrum for the difference line. And it's called 4-0.
Yeah. I mean, you don't see no correlation matrix here. The patches, the differences are better.
That's true. Signal to noise is quite poor on the edges, right? So. Okay, because we have much fewer hits on the edges. Okay. So, Radix. Right. That's why, obviously, you need the noise correlation matrix. It's not a full statistic just to have the map. Okay, so now let me move to foregrounds. There were some comments. It's on the order of 1/10, but maybe it's 1/8 or something.
Right. If you just look at the Jupiter scan, you can see that there's slight asymmetry, but not great.
Is that not object? Is that what you get your time constant?
We go 4 degrees.
Yeah.
If you go over like that.
Yeah.
Sorry, so, and that's taking into your 4% calibration, you roll in the.
Right, but that's not so important. Well, that's not so. The time constant is obviously not so important for the dipole calibration, right? So, and then what you have to do is we unfold the bolometer time constant. So once you deconvolve that, if you look at the noise spectrum, it's rising up like that. But it has the bolometer time constant role taken out already. Yeah, it's about a factor, I said about 8 or something. I think that's about right. And we have about 10 millisecond bolometers. Okay. So in principle, even if we did have blurring, we could take it out.
Because you measured it in the Jupiter scan.
Right. And that's how we measure the time constants, actually. It's the leftward and rightward passing of Jupiter. Okay, so there were some comments yesterday that experimentalists need to report more on foreground, so I thought I'd talk a little bit about that. And try to convince you that we have thought a little bit about foreground contamination in our field. So I wasn't going to show this, but I just wanted to remind people that 150 gigahertz is quite a good frequency if you want to avoid foregrounds. So if you're trying to measure in this region from L of several hundred to 1,000, 150 gigahertz gets you away from a lot of bad things down here, and the main worry will be galactic dust up here at high frequencies. So one of the things that we really have to show in our data set is that we're free of galactic dust, and we're less worried about these low frequency foregrounds. All right, but let me go through it in detail. First off, we have quite a choice of sky region given our scan strategy. So we chose our sky region for the lowest dust and lowest point source contamination. So within that sky region that we chose, the predicted amplitudes of the foregrounds are quite low. And also what we see is that the signal has a frequency spectrum consistent with the cosmic microwave background. So those two last points are shown in this table. So what I'm showing is data here, and then different foregrounds, dust, synchrotron, and free-free. And in this first column, I'm showing the 150 gigahertz RMS, so it's about 130 microkelvin. And then for dust, the prediction, and this is based on Doug Finkbeiner's map, so SFD98 map with his extrapolation, we expect about 2.3 microkelvin. It's quite low, and 0.5 microkelvin, 0.15. So again, as I said, synchrotron free-free, we expect to be very low. This here is the ratio between the 150 gigahertz and 250 gigahertz RMSs in thermodynamic units. So what we expect is unity for the cosmic microwave background, and we get something consistent with that. And what we'd expect for dust, synchrotron free-free are listed here, and clearly this entire signal does not come from the foreground. It's much more consistent with the cosmic microwave background. So to go on further, for dust, not only is the expected RMS low, but the signal actually has the expected correlation with the SFD98 map. So we cross-correlate with that map, and we do get a cross-correlation. We do see a detection, but it has the amplitude that we expect. Next, talking about point sources, we do a catalog search that's based on Sokazian, Gauweiser, and Smoot. And Gauweiser and Smoot here, and Eric talked about these yesterday, so I won't go into it more. And finally, what I already pointed out is that, what I didn't say is that we chose the field to have low point source contamination, and indeed at 150 gigahertz, there should be no detectable point sources according to these catalogs. And as I said, as I showed earlier, the structure is temporally stable and independent of elevation, so that argues against atmosphere or side lobe contamination. No point source is detectable. Obviously, there's a lot of point sources there. You mean just of the maps, or so? For example, if we cut out little parts of the map and looked at that, we haven't done that yet. But we're starting to look more into point sources, and that'd be a good thing to do. Okay. Just to show the region that we measured, this is the SFD map. This is in galactic coordinates. The ring of fire you see here is the galaxy, and you can see what we've chosen here is one of the very darkest parts of the northern hemisphere, right here. Now, this map on the left is the maximum CMB map at 150 gigahertz, and the map on the right is the SFD map scaled correctly for thermodynamic units. So this is the level of contamination that we expect in that map from galactic dust. So as you can see, we picked a region that's very low in galactic dust. Now, to see any dust, we have to blow up the scale. Okay, so here the scale has been blown up by a factor of 15, I believe. And so now you can at least see features. And as I said, this map does correlate with that map at the level expected. So we do see this. We can detect this dust, but it's at the level we expect. Okay, so that's the end of the foregrounds. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the cosmology. Here's the maximum one power spectrum. In L, of course, on the x-axis, and C sub L on the y-axis. And here's a measurement out to L of 785. What you see here is the black points are the actual power spectrum. The open points is the power spectrum of the difference of A plus B minus C plus D, which is consistent with zero. And the two lines you see here, the dark line is the best fit, and the dashed line here is a standard lambda CDM model. and I put the parameters of the best fit in the Lambda CDM here at the bottom. And the you can see that the fits are acceptable for both. The chi-squareds are 8 and 10 for the 10 bins that we have here. You've also probably seen this plot comparing Maxima and Boomerang. Both of them shifted respectively by their calibration error, assuming that that's the best solution to putting them together. And for me, the nicest thing about this is that this is a very good systematic error check, because these are completely independent experiments. They measured about 90 degrees, a portion of the sky that's 90 degrees different, and the power spectra are fairly consistent over the entire range. Okay, so now on to more about cosmology. So this is what we get from, this is from Balbi et al. That came out at the same time as the experimental part of the publications. And this is the standard plot of omega lambda versus omega m. And here's what you get from Maxima 1 and COBE. And COBE has a tendency to close down that corner up there. And so it's consistent overall. It's consistent with flat, but the peak is at slightly open. And you can see that best here, where we collapse down that 2D into this 1D with omega total. And you can see that, again, consistent with omega total is 1, but slightly open. And the dash line you see here is if you put the prior in for BBN, and you can see that it doesn't change things much if we put that prior in. It's about 1. I'd say a little bit more than 1. This is another one of the standard plots that you can make. And here what we do is we put the supernova data in here, and the bullseyes you see here are the combined likelihood of the supernova data and Maxima data. In detail, here are some of the parameters that we can measure just from Maxima data alone, well, including DMR. And so we can measure omega BH squared. And here, it looks like we're consistent with BBN at about 1 sigma. But what we've realized is that we really need to sample more finely in here to get a more accurate idea of how this curve is falling. So that's in progress right now. And here's omega CDM, H squared, and finally NS, spectral tilt. Now, more recently, we have also been working with Dick Bond and Dmitry Pogosian in Toronto and Andrew Jaffe together to do an independent parameter estimation. And this has been very valuable because with two different analyses, we can cross-check each other and see what things are important. And there's going to be other talks about that, but I'll just show a couple plots provided to me. And here's one. That's the same plot as I showed before, so omega m, omega lambda, and you can see that the omega total is a little bit more close to critical than in our analysis, and we're looking into that right now. And finally, this is interesting. If you include the effect of large-scale structure, and this is from work of also Jaffe and Bond and others, you can actually close down this corner, as you'd expect. Knowing something about omega m tells you something in this direction. So either the combination of CMB and large-scale structure or the combination of CMB and supernova 1A are arguing for some significant omega lambda. Yeah, for not a big effect. Okay. So final two view graphs. We have more data. This shows the scan pattern for Maxima 1 on this side, Maxima 2 on this side. Again, it's DEC versus RA. And you can see that the blue part here is what we observed in Maxima 2. And you can see that the pilot went to pilot training school and this time was able to nail the cross-linking right on. And you can see that we've measured about 1.5 times more sky in the second flight. And importantly, what we've done is we've been able to overlap the first year's data and the second year's data. So we should be able to cross-correlate those two maps and see if we're measuring consistent sky structure. So all put together, we measured 300 square degrees. That's 0.75% of the sky, or 11,000 beam-sized pixels. And in the slightly longer-term future, we will be trying to measure CMB polarization anisotropy. And just very briefly, this is going to be called maxipole, pole for polarization, obviously. And it's based on the Maxima instrument. We're going to go for slightly longer flights, 30-hour turnaround flights from Fort Sumner. We project that we can measure about 350 10 arc minute pixels. That's about 10 squared degrees with 8 microkelvin RMS noise in a single balloon flight. And the focal plane will look something like this, with grids to define polarizations. It will difference pixels in the focal plane. We are planning to add some 90 gigahertz channels down here at the end of the focal plane, and we hope to get a fairly sensitive detection of the E modes if they're there. Thanks. Let's see. So I don't have Andrew. Do you remember what the? I haven't looked at dust maps.
I don't remember the map, but it correlates perfectly with what. Yeah, I'll show the plot that we talked about today.
Yeah.
It looks beautiful.
Good.
Oh. You mean why we did? Mm-hmm. Okay, so data analysis of each channel takes quite a long time, and the channels vary in their sensitivity. So there's probably about, of the 8 that I talked about, 6 have good sensitivity, and 2 of them had some difficulties. So what we tried to do is try to optimize roughly effort versus cosmology gain. And so those 4 channels gave us the best bang for the buck in terms of getting it out relatively quickly, but having enough sensitivity to make the systematic checks we wanted and to see some good signal. Three of us. John will get his chance, right? One of the reasons is it takes us longer to do systematic checks out that far. And for example, we did most of our systematic checks with 8 or 10 arc minute pixels. And when we compared to 5 arc minute, we found that there was virtually no change in the power spectrum. So we feel quite confident that doing 8 or 10 arc minute is fine for what we've shown. And actually, it might be okay for going out further, but we weren't absolutely sure of that, so we wanted to hold off for a while. But the sensitivity, I think we'll have a stronger result when we're able to put in more data too, because obviously our B sub L squared is starting to roll off there, right? So our sensitivity is rolling off. So we'd like to probably add more data in to get a good measurement of that region. Complex deconvolution of the entire time stream. And also we have electronic filters that we take out too. That's right, single time constant modeling. But remember that, as we were discussing before, we have a very high signal noise measurement of Jupiter. So when you first look at Jupiter without deconvolving all this, you see 2 lobes, right, for leftward and rightward. And so when you put in your model, your goal is to make the 2 lobes line up, okay? And so to the extent that your model, your electronic, your model of the time constant is good, you'll get those to line up, and that works fairly successfully.
How well did your dipole and Jupiter calibration
agree? To within the error of Jupiter, which is a lot larger. So this is actually what we were discussing in the audience yesterday. And so, as was pointed out, basically a 5% error in your full width half max leads to a 10% error in your Jupiter calibration, and that's about the error we have. So we have about 12 to 14% Jupiter error, and so within that error, yeah, they agree well, but it's unfortunately we don't have two equal quality calibrators to cross check. No, and we're going to include them, but they're not. It's not a big effect. So although formally we should include them, it visually you wouldn't be able to tell much difference in the error bars. So if you take a 5% error on a 10 arc minute beam, the envelope is not very big. I guess Max has been waiting. Oh, sorry. Max has been waiting back there.
I talked to Paul Richards over lunch, and he said that you were hoping to make both the Max and the Aquarius make you public at some point, because I think it would be an awesome thing for the whole community. I think I'm not alone here in doing something like that. But I was wondering if you could comment a bit more on sort of what your time scale is, what papers you want to get accepted, and, you know,
Well, Santa Claus all arrives on one particular night of the year. We definitely want to release everything, and I would say it's almost more that we have a big group of people working together, and we all have to kind of get together and agree, and we're just very busy, that we haven't set a date that where we're going to release things. So certainly the correlation matrices, I mean, for example, those could be released not in the not-so-distant future. And we do want to release all that stuff, but just have to get together and talk about it. Lloyd?
Why is your full depth only about?
Yeah, if you would guess as a straight signal noise ratio, but remember, you look at those contours, and they were in the contour plot, and there were wiggles in it. Right, and so there's first of all, there's finite gridding. If you imagine one map across the beam, we get about 10 points across that beam. So that makes a finite grid on that two-dimensional plot that I showed. And also there's baseline subtraction. Each time if we make a measurement for about 10 or 15 minutes, we have baselines that we have to subtract off. So all told, and I think 5% is probably conservative, but we could afford to be conservative there. So.
I think there's one comment, which is it's not that our full width half max is another 5%. The amplitude of GL is much smaller than full width half max.
Do you think the BL is Gaussian?
No. No, we measure our BL using this procedure for symmetrizing it.
I thought.
So beam is a function of L.
Well, I don't want to disagree with my team member, but I thought the way it went is that we when we measured the beams, we thought it was 5% error in a full width half max, and then that propagated through Prodi's analysis, right? But we can go offline. But that's what I thought.
Yeah.
Huh? So which way do you remember it?
My understanding is that Prodi had a
Okay.
Some combination of the two that sets it apart.
Right. Maxima 2 is busy being analyzed, so it's as complicated as Maxima 1. We've had a little more practice, but it'll take a while to churn through.